I think that the worst advice that we could ever get is do what makes you happy. Neutral is just making a bunch of noise, but not going anywhere. I try to take these mental snapshots, and I tell her, I said, if I'm afraid of anything, I'm afraid I'm not going to remember like the little moments. The more meaning I have in my life, the happier I am.
All right, welcome to the Rad Dad Podcast. This is episode 36. I have Bryce Kenny on. Bryce, your team reached out to me, and in the title it said monster truck driver, and I immediately knew I had to have you on because I have a three-year-old that is just absolutely obsessed. So,
oh, good.
Super happy to have you on.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I love the logo behind your head, by the way. I think that's just sparking all sorts of creativity in my mind, and so I'm going to have to match that level of commitment over here in my studio in North Carolina. But I do have to ask you one thing, Jace. Is your three-year-old, is he a Gravedigger fan?
Absolutely.
Ah, so we can just end the podcast
right. But he's here. also a Mohawk Warrior fan.
Oh, good. Okay.
And right. He has a Mohawk.
Oh, he has a Mohawk.
Yes.
Okay. All right. We're good then. We're totally good.
Okay.
I guess he can cheer for us both, but at some point he's got to make a decision. I'm just going to go ahead and warn you.
Okay. I'll let him know.
All right.
Awesome. Well, just to get into it, I start my episodes off just asking the same question. That's just tell me a little bit about your upbringing and your childhood.
Yeah. I came from a family of all boys. So I'm the third of four boys, and, my parents, they are still married, you know, so that's awesome. But I tell you what is so amazing is that my relationship, my friendship with my grandfather was incredibly deep. And he owned a drag strip up in Clay City, Kentucky. And I would get out of school for summer break. I would immediately go up to Kentucky and I would weed eat the fence lines during the week. And I would jump in our little junior dragster on the weekend. And that's how I got to just be around the sport. And I was obsessed. Everything in my life, I wanted to be a professional drag racer. And it was because of that. And I was very thankful that my parents let me spend all of my summers up there on my grandparents' farm. It was an 80-acre farm on top of a Kentucky mountain. And like I said, on the weekends, we'd go and run the drag strip together. So it was just really, really cool. Very, very different. Of course, my brothers and I, we always wrestled for who got to drive the junior dragster that weekend as well.
That's awesome. That sounds like a kind of an all-American upbringing.
Yeah, it is. I'm very patriotic. That's what, you know, you say all-American. I love the fact, you know, we shot guns up there on the farm. Like, it was kind of a man's paradise, to your point. Like, we had ATVs. We had two ponds to fish in. It was a man's paradise. I loved going up there. I felt like by the time I was 13, I'd come home and interact with all my buddies at school and just be like, what did you guys do all summer? They're like, well, we went to the pool. You know, we went to the pool. You went to the swimming pool all summer long? Like, and then I got to tell them all the crazy stuff I got to do, like driving a car all over the farm at 9 years old, right? So, yeah. It was definitely an all-American upbringing.
That's awesome. I love that. Are there any attributes that you recognize early on in your grandpa and then your dad and then that maybe you have developed as a father?
Yeah, I think my grandfather, it's funny. So my grandfather was very, very stern. I don't think he was around, you know, he had 13 grandkids. And me being one of them. And it was interesting because he was an only child growing up himself. And so until I was about 12 or 13, I didn't really get to have a relationship with him because he was working and, you know, he was kind of grandpa. Like, honestly, you kind of stayed away from him. And then all of a sudden when he sold the drag strip and bought a Top Fuel dragster and we started going professional drag racing, I remember going to him and just asking, can I please come? And I was begging him. I was like, I'll clean the car. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. Like, I just want to come and help and be on the crew. Cause we had a team of eight guys that, you know, that thrashed on this dragster between each round going 300 miles an hour in 4 seconds. And that's how all that started. And so, you know, the attributes I learned probably as the dad side of me is there's a, that I learned from my grandfather is there's a key balance, I think, between trying to be your kid's friend versus being their dad. Like, they need a dad first. They need a leader first and a friend second. And you can't always be both. Like, there are those magical moments where you get to be both. right? I'm not one of those guys like, you can't be your kid's friends. Like, no, there's a time right. and a place for building that friendship. But right now they just need a strong father figure. My dad, so it's actually my mom's dad is the grandfather I'm talking about. And she is like this big cheerleader. Here I'm out there like crashing for a living. I'm a professional crash test dummy, right? As a Monster Jam driver. And she loves it. She'll see videos from the weekend and be like, Bryce, that was incredible. You know, and she's like, my dad is a chiropractor and he's real soft spoken. And he is, he's the one that's always texting me after the weekend, like, Bryce, I saw your crash this weekend, buddy. You want to come in for an adjustment? You know, I'm like, yeah, dad. So my dad's the one that gets to put Humpty Dumpty back together again after each weekend. But the attribute that I'd say I'd take from my dad is he was such an amazing provider, and he always had the faith that he would provide. But he also worked really long hours. So he was always around on the weekends. Like, there were very few games that he missed, but he was not there during the week. And it was one of the reasons I decided not to be a chiropractor, just because I was like, man, I never got to see my dad growing up during the week, except maybe for a few minutes at dinner. And that was about it. But the thing that he always told me that I have adopted to my kids is, you know, he always, for all of the things that he gives himself a hard time about the things that he didn't do for us growing up and how absent he says he was, and probably he was, you know, to a degree. The thing he always told me was that he was proud of me. Always. And so that's honestly, that's all I needed. That's all I needed. He was an amazing provider. Like, yeah, I wish I could have spent more time with my dad growing up. But he would always look at me after a soccer game or after something I did and say, buddy, I'm proud of you. And that's definitely something I've taken in. I've taken it one step further, Jace. This is a super long answer to your question. But I've taken it one step further. And I don't know who I stole this from, but once I heard it, I was like, that's it. And I've seen it already in my 8 and 6-year-old make a big difference. Is I tell them, buddy, Keegan comes off the soccer field. I'm like, buddy, I am so proud of you. And he goes, thanks, dad. And I'm like, but Keegan, let me ask you, are you proud of yourself? Are you proud of your effort you gave today? And he's learned, and he's starting to go, yeah, I'm proud of myself. And what I heard that piece of gold from someone not that long ago that recommended doing that to your kids. Cause they said, look, you're not always going to be there. Like, my dad's not there for me today. Like, when I'm on a Monster Jam, tour and stuff like that. And if I didn't know how to have some self pride and be proud of myself on the effort that I had, and it was only wrapped up in my dad telling me that, like, that's good, but not great. Like, I to be both and to have that for both of those items for my son and my daughters, that's what I want the most. I want them to know, look, daddy is proud of you, but let me ask you, are you proud of the effort you gave today? And then listening to them answer that, I think that's been critical. And my kids are only 8, 6, and 2. So I'm hoping it really does pay off, but I know it will.
Yeah. I love that concept because you're teaching your kids this skill at a young age, and it allows them to create a purpose in their lives or something that they can be proud of. I think kids mm-hmm. need that in their lives early in their development and be able to kind of self-teach themselves with guidance that they can do hard things. Yes. Is there a skill that you learned in your childhood that's maybe unique that you still use to this day?
I would say the skill that I got wrong.
Okay. Let's go with that.
So my personality, I've got a very strong personality. And if you study personality types, I'm a choleric. And a choleric is kind of that lion, you know, if you've ever seen the animal attributes, I'm a mm-hmm. lion. So that means like I have a very big roar, right? And I don't always think about, you know, taking care of the pride and everybody else around me. It's like, no, we're just hunting today. That's all we're doing. And, you know, when I was in athletics and when I was in middle school, I got it really bad and really wrong, where it was just like, you know what? All these other people are just weak. You know, I've got a job to do. I got goals to get done and all this stuff. And if they're not able to hang with me, then they're weak. And it's like I was leaving dead bodies in my wake. And, you know, I just think, well, I'll just pick them all back up afterwards. And I was very successful. Like I always played at a very high level in athletics. winning championships, state championships, stuff like that. But it wasn't until after high school I got into college and I actually picked up a people skill book for the first time ever. And I started to realize, oh, it's not because they're weak and I'm strong. It's that they're wired differently. And guess what? The choleric side, like, yes, that's a natural leader. You know, people say, oh, he's a natural leader. That's probably just because they're a choleric, because they're a little bit more outspoken and a little hungry for to get the results. But just because someone's a melancholy or someone's a phlegmatic or a sanguine, and also made me realize when I meet somebody, still to this day, I will meet somebody and sometimes I'm like, dude, I just do not like that person. You know?
Yeah.
But the reason is because they're a sanguine, and sanguine and cholerics always kind of butt heads naturally, because the sanguine is always trying to be the life of the party and like the center of attention. The cleric is, you know, I'm literally wearing gray and black. And I was about to say, like, clerics wear kind of gray and black clothing. Like, they just don't want to stand out. They don't want to walk in a room and be noticed. Now, I do wear a mohawk because that's my job, but yeah. I wasn't a mohawk guy. If it wasn't for my career, that's probably wouldn't have been my hairstyle of choice. And so, growing up, I got it so wrong that I had to change if I was going to ever be a person of influence. And that was the biggest lesson of my childhood, is getting it wrong. And that drives me more today to pay more attention, to people and how they're wired and their personalities, and then meet them where they are. Like, understand what a sanguine is looking for. Understand why a melancholy has to start our driver's meeting on time, or they get like really flustered and upset if we start 5 minutes late. It's because that's the way they're wired. And it gives me the patience to work with them. And so that's the biggest lesson I've taken in. And that's made a huge difference, as an adult today, especially dealing with people as much as I do.
Awesome. Talk me through your career from being 9 years old and driving a car on your grandpa's property to where you're at now.
So when I was 13, I started working on our family Top Fuel dragster. You know, my grandfather was the one driving. You know, here we're buckling him into a 300 mile an hour machine. And well, I loved it too. I loved, you know, telling him, hey buddy, go have fun, that kind of thing. And then going to pick him up at the end of the track and seeing the smile on a 68 year old man chasing his dream. That was so cool for me. Well, I wanted to do that. That was my whole dream. I wanted to be a professional Top Fuel driver. That was my whole goal in life. And I got to do it. So I got my license and I was 20 years old when I started, and I ran hard for 3 years trying to make it a career. And man, I just failed. I got my teeth kicked in. I was going into corporate boardrooms all the time, trying to convince people to give me $3 million to put their company on the side of my race car. And, you know, it was my grandfather's race car, but I had 7 different jobs at that time funneling into making that dream happen. And I failed. And my family sometimes is like, they're real sensitive about me saying that. I'm going, why is that a bad thing? They're like, oh, you didn't fail. You did such a great job with what you had. And I'm like, I failed. And it's okay, because the stuff I learned then, I use every single day in my career now. And I'm more committed to what I'm doing now because I know how fragile being a professional driver really is. And so, but I went from professional drag racing. And as soon as we left that, I went to my grandfather and said, do not keep this for me. Like, you've done so much for me already. I have sat on your shoulders, right? And the work that you've done over 50 years. And if I have to go and work for 50 years of my own life to get back here and do what you did, then I'll do it. And so I went into corporate America, and my goal was to create wealth. And that's when Monster Jam called me 4 years into that corporate job. And honestly, Jace, I was struggling because I had really kind of set up a good life. Like, it was pretty comfortable, you know, and during those 4 years, I got married. We bought a house. We had our first child, and I was kind of settling in, and I was like, man, I'm going to run as hard as I can for 30 years. And then, so when Monster Jam called me and they're like, hey, we've had your information for the last 4 years, would you be interested in coming to Monster Jam University, which is a real place, by the way?
I've heard about it.
Real university. They give you a diploma afterwards, which is kind of a little bit too much in my opinion. But anyway, they said, do you want to come to Monster Jam University? And I said, well, what does that look like? Because my first thought was honestly, how much is this going to cost me? Because how much money I put into the Top Fuel stuff, I was going, man, I can't go down that route, especially something for something I'm not real passionate about. Right. And they said, no, I mean, it's our equipment. We've got the largest motorsports fleet in the world. Like, it's taken care of. And I said, oh, so just like a flight in a hotel? You know, I'm going, man, for $1,000, I might do this. And they were funny because they were kind of frustrated. And they're like, no, Bryce, we'll buy you a flight in a hotel. Can you just be in Illinois to test in a Monster Jam truck? And I went, of course I can do that. Like, who would ever say no to that opportunity? Yeah, it was the best chance in the world. You know, I didn't think it would go anywhere. I thought one day I'd be in a Buffalo Wild Wings and it would come up on TV and I'd get to nudge my buddy sitting next to me and be like, dude, did you know I drove one of those one time 10 years ago? That's as far as I thought it would go. That was 8 years ago, almost nine, and it's just gotten better every year. I've been full time with Monster Jam now for 7 years. And I don't regret a second of it. And Monster Jam University, I did not keep my diploma, by the way, because I thought it was ridiculous. And I left it in the hotel. I really should have kept it because I cannot tell you, Jace, how many times I bring it up now.
That's awesome. I have so many questions about monster trucks and everything, but I want to get back into your four-year piece in corporate America. Was it a hard decision to leave? Because I know you get attached to like a lifestyle and a comfort zone. Was it hard to take that leap and just completely pivot your career?
Yeah. So I told Monster Jam no three times when it was okay. Up. It was at a point where I was going to have to leave my corporate job. And what happened was that gotcha. Great Clips, who's my sponsor now, Monster Jam put my name forward whenever Great Clips came around to sponsor a truck. I was one of the drivers as an option. And Monster Jam called me and they said, hey, we put your name forward. And I was like, nope. I said, don't do it. I said, I know what it takes to be an ambassador for a brand. I cannot do that. I cannot do my corporate job and Monster Jam. Said, okay. They called me a month later. Bryce, we know you told us to take your name off the list. We didn't. You're one of the finalists of this truck. What do you think? And I'm like, absolutely not. Guys, I already told you. Thank you. I'm honored, but no. One more month goes by and they call me back and they're kind of like, hey, Bryce, you know, they're like all this small talk. And I'm like, guys, what are you calling me for? Well, we know you said that and we just never did. And they've officially chosen you as the driver of the Great Clips Mohawk Warrior truck. Like, what's it going to take? And I did not know that it was Great Clips at the time. So that was my first question was, well, who's the company? Yeah. And they said, Great Clips. And I looked them up and, you know, I did some, I said, just give me some time to think about this. And so I looked them up. I did all kinds of research about them. I loved that they were a $1.7 billion company. I loved that they were a franchise company. So they had 1,000 franchisees in their system, which meant 1,000 CEOs. And my corporate job was placing CEOs and CFOs into private equity backed companies. And so I got it. Like I knew what these entrepreneurs were doing and building. And I knew that if I went out there to work with these franchisees that I could do that as an ambassador. And so it took me a long time though, because just to your point, we had built a good life. Like I had a good retirement plan going. My wife saw me every night, even though it was very long hours. You know, I'd start at 8 o'clock, work till 6:30, come home, eat dinner. And I'd plug back in at 9 PM and, you know, and I'd take Friday night, Saturday off, and then I'd plug back in Sunday night. I mean, it was an 80-hour work week, easy, but it was very lucrative. And so when Monster Jam, I remember I was standing in my shop, Jace, and I was at that point, I had to make the decision on what I was going to do. And I was looking around my shop and all the stuff on the walls and every piece of memorabilia, everything that had meant something or showed some memory of my life, it had everything that had to do with racing, right? There wasn't some CEO I had placed up on my wall somewhere. It was all about racing. And I remembered in that moment who I wanted to be as a human being. And it was someone who uses the platform of motorsports to impact this world. And so I said to myself, well, if that's who you want to be, then the what of Monster Jam aligns with that. And I actually took a 30% pay cut. I left my corporate job and I went full-time in with Monster Jam. And now, man, that was 7 years ago. I've been full-time 7 years and it's gotten better every single year. And I don't regret the decision for a second because the what we do in our lives, our what changes, but when we understand and have a crystal clear picture of who we want to be, like the best version of ourselves, the best Bryce Kenny, you know, what is it? How would Bryce be described? How would I be described today? How do I want to be described a year from now? And when I'm focused on that, the what seems to align with that and fall into place a lot easier.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for sharing that. I'm very curious to get your thoughts on imposter syndrome, because you went from corporate America into literally a completely different arena. I've struggled with that starting this podcast because my career is behind the camera. So I do marketing and content for companies, and now I'm in front of the camera, and I've avoided that my whole adult life. And I've just struggled with that a lot. And I wanted to get your thoughts on how you've dealt with that. And yeah.
Yeah. Do you still edit all your stuff, by the way?
Yep. I'm a one-man show.
One-man show. I love that, by the way. I also love that you kind of found this next gear. And I love the fact that you did step out of your comfort zone. And I think it's a testament to not just taking more risks, but it's also being more creative. And I talk a lot about that in my book. But, you know, imposter syndrome is interesting because we live by this motto, and we've all heard it. Like, Jason, finish this motto for me. Fake it till you
make it.
Make it. Yeah. All of us have heard that, right? And I think it's a good motto. It's not great. A great perspective to take into anything. And you've had that perspective, right? Fake it till you made it. And when it comes to like being a podcast host and stuff like that, but a great perspective to have and a shift in mindset that we all have to have, we're going to get off of imposter syndrome, is to believe it until you become it. Like, you have to believe that you are a podcast host until you become a podcast host. That's the only way to really shift into a better version of ourselves and understand what's next in our lives, because it's not about faking it until you make it. It's about believing you are. And I did this with my book, right? Geared for Life. I wrote this book, and I got on the phone. One of the first calls I ever had with my publisher, I said, guys, I am not an author. I'm not an author, blah, blah, blah. And I just said, like, I'm going to need some help. I need your help polishing this. I need your help doing this, blah, blah, blah. And I went off on this whole tangent, and they finally stopped me. They said, Bryce, you got to stop saying you're an author or not an author. They said, you wrote a book, so you're an author. that's what qualifies you to be an author, is you wrote a book. So you got to believe that you're an author. And that's one of the biggest shifts that I made mentally in that, is like, man, I could fake being an author until I, you know, sold some books and made it, right? Or I can believe I'm an author until I actually become an author. And that's what happened. And so we got after that. Once I believed that I was an author, man, the book came alive. I found such better stories to use to drive home points. I found another gear as an author I never knew I had. Once I believed I was an author, I actually became one. And so imposter syndrome, the easiest way and the best way to go after that identity crisis that some of us have is to attach what we're doing to the who we want to be. Like, I'm big on that too. A lot of people, if my whole identity was based around my what I do for a living, meaning driving a truck, that's where imposter syndrome is so hard to battle against, because it's not about what I do. It's about who I become in the process that matters the most. And if I have a good handle on who I want to be, the best version of Bryce Kenny a year from today, then it's easier to let the what align with that. And that's where the imposter syndrome, I don't feel like an imposter whenever I think about a better version of myself. And for you, you know, you think about how you want to be described as a podcast host a year from today. That's going to give you the ability to find this next year as a podcast host that you never knew you had, because you're more focused on, you know, how you'd want to be described as a professional 12 months from today versus today. And that's going to drive all the what. But I'm a big believer in that, man. If you can believe it until you become it, imposter syndrome seems to take a backseat.
This last year has been an awesome journey for me, and I am now ready to take the Rad Dad brand to the next step, which is building out our website that'll offer a lot of free resources for dads and parents alike to just become better men and also connect with their spouses and children. So please like and subscribe to continue to follow us on our journey. Thank you. I've never, You know, the way you describe that, it makes me think of the law of attraction. I'm a big believer in the law of attraction, but I've never made the connection between that and overcoming imposter syndrome. So that's a great explanation. I really like that.
Oh, good. Yeah.
In your book, you talk about finding the next gear. And I got to thinking about that concept, and I wanted to get your thoughts on the neutral gear, because I started thinking, like, you know, neutral, you can still move, but it may not be at your own will. It may not be at the speed that you want. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you think in as far as neutral and maybe what that means for you.
I think all of us have been in that scenario where our head hits the pillow at night and we think to ourselves, is this really it? Like, is this really all there is to life? And it might be that 20-year-old in college that just cannot figure out what to major in. Maybe it's the 35-year-old professional that's like, man, I just thought, you know, going down this path would have been a lot more fun or more, you know, more productive or paid better, whatever it might be. Or maybe it's the guy that just retired at 65 that's like, man, I just thought retirement would be a lot better than this. You know, we all have been there and we've all set that up. That's neutral. Like that feeling of just like, oh, man, I don't know what to do. And I feel like this is just not what life was all cracked up to be.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of people accept neutral and they slow down, because what happens is they start to think about what they're not doing enough of. They start to think about who they've not become along the way, how much money's not in their bank account. And they begin to accept it. They begin to accept, and it's a dangerous position to be in, because they start to think, I guess this is it. And then they just keep doing that. That's neutral. Neutral is just making a bunch of noise, but not going anywhere, right? Sure, you can, if you're on a hill and you're a neutral, it can roll away. But if you're a neutral, you can't, you can have all the power in the world. I got a hot rod sitting in my shop right here with 600 horsepower in it. It fits in neutral. It doesn't matter. I can step on the throttle and have all 600 horsepower going out the exhaust and tailpipe. I'm not moving an inch. And that's what happens. We can make a bunch of noise, but we're not really moving anywhere. And the problem is just a shift into first gear. And that's the big question. Like, well, then how do you get moving again? And I'm a big believer that perspective shift begins to work on us. But what that perspective has to be about, you know, I've berated the point about understanding what the best version of us looks like. But that first gear is the thing that you believe in the most. That's your first gear, right? And being able to find that belief and understand what you believe at your core, belief drives action and action drives results. And then results ultimately lead to momentum. And momentum is what ultimately is what, you know, makes someone successful versus not successful. But it all starts with, what do you believe? Do you believe that your job, let's say someone's an accountant, and they believe that accountants are a waste of money for people, do you think that person's going to be very successful as an accountant?
No.
No. And they're not going to work. They're not going to work long hours and do all that stuff because they don't believe there's value there. Something as simple as that. Or maybe it's, man, Jace, it could be someone that just believes that animals deserve to be protected. Well, do you think that person is holding dog fights in their backyard on the weekends? No. Right? Hopefully because our beliefs shape our actions, and our actions are what build results. And so, you know, you talk about law of attraction, you talk about this stuff that we're all trying to figure out, man, if we can get back to understanding what we believe, because I'm a big believer that, our foundational beliefs are what our gears are. And I share in Geared for Life. That's what my book is all about. It's my 7 personal gears, my foundational beliefs that have shaped my decisions over the last 10 years that have enabled me to create this crazy life as a professional Monster Jam driver, set Guinness World Records, still be married for the last 12 years through all of that, be a dad to 3 amazing kids. And it's not because I'm better than anybody. It's because I know what I believe in more than most people, and they've become gears for me. And so sometimes I shift into my purpose-driven gear, and I make a purpose decision, not a monetary decision. Just like when I left my corporate job for Monster Jam, that was a purpose-based decision, not a monetary. I took a 30% pay cut, like I said. But maybe sometimes I'm in Monster Jam and I want the results, man. My last World Finals, I thought that was going to be the moment for me to etch my name into the history of the sport. And dude, that day blew up in my face. Not literally, quite, you know, thankfully, right? I guess I got to qualify that since it's Monster Jam. But it wasn't that all of a sudden the truck didn't cooperate. It kicked me out of racing. It had nothing to do with my performance. And then it did it again in freestyle to the point where I didn't even get to compete that day. And I could either be furious because my chapter and my platform didn't grow. It didn't go the way I thought. But I remember I had to make a conscious decision to shift into my being built for others gear. And I said, like, after 10 minutes of being furious about the day and the situation, and I threw my helmet in the locker room and all that stuff, I finally sat down. I was like, all right, you got a choice. Sit here and live in your emotion, or shift into being built for others. And you can go out in the stadium and be the loudest cheerleader in the entire stadium and be there to celebrate one of your buddies who's about to win a world championship and about to have the best day of their career. And that's what I did. So I was standing on the podium when Colt Stevens won his very first freestyle world championship. And I gave him the biggest hug. I was the first guy to hug him, dude. And we were freaking out together. I was so happy for him in that moment. And it was because I had to consciously shift into a different gear because of what life was throwing my way. And so you've got to find the right gear at the right time. And if you do that, you'll never be in neutral. You'll never get stuck. And you're never going to get burnt out either, because it's a matter of shifting into a different gear than you're in now.
I love that. One of my biggest fears as a father is that in 20 years, my kids are going to realize that I was the burnt out dad or the tired dad, you know? And that gives me some insight into exploring what my gears are and being able to apply them, you know, just to being a dad. What skills have you learned as a father that have helped you in your career path?
I think it's one of my gears is make memories, not egos.
Okay.
I shift into that as a father all the time. Like, it's important that helps me as a professional, because it makes me get out of my hotel room and like drive around the city that I'm in with another driver, you know, and just go explore when I don't want to do that. I want to sit in the hotel room and work on something or watch Netflix. But I shift into that most often as a dad, because when I'm home, those memories are so precious. And I talk about something in the book called A Time Traveler's Perspective. And I think about the fact that, man, in 20 years, you talk about 20 years from now and how you want to be perceived. And that's that who, by the way. Like, you've got a clear picture of how you want your kids to describe you one day. Right? That's critical, because that drives the what you should do, which is get your butt off the couch and go play with your kid or go make a memory together. But I've got this thing called Time Traveler's Perspective. And what it's about is, in 20 years from now, I will give anything if I could travel back in time for today and go out there and actually play with my son who just asked me to go play RC cars.
Right.
Right. And I don't have to travel in time. I'm in the now, right now. But I imagine that I'm a 55-year-old guy where my son's about to get married or something like that. And I long for the opportunity to just go back for one day and go and kick the soccer ball with my 6-year-old. But no, I can't do that, because he's going to be 26 and living his own life. He's not going to be asking me to go out back and kick the soccer ball around or play RC cars. So why wait for 20 years from now? And so that perspective has helped me more than anything. Get my butt off the couch, go out there, and again, focus on making memories instead of building my own ego. And building my own ego could be doing something for work. It could be going and doing and making better social media content, or maybe or figuring out if my last post was good, or how did I do this weekend, and what people are saying about my results in Monster Jam. That's a big thing, man. If we can all have a time traveler's perspective and recognize, man, we would give anything to live in today. One day we would give anything to live today again. That changes everything in that perspective. It makes us go out there and make memories. And those, to me, are the real trophies. It's not my name up in lights in front of 50,000 people driving a Monster Jam truck. Those aren't the trophies. That World Finals championship that I wanted so bad to win a couple months ago. Yeah, that's a humongous trophy. But that trophy will not last. It's going out there and making these memories with my kids that's ultimately going to outlast everything. And that's got to be the best way and the only way to really go out there and make a difference in our kids. And you talk about 20 years from now, you want to be viewed as that dad that wasn't exhausted or wasn't too tired. But dude, if you're aware of that, that's not going to happen, man. Your kids aren't going to describe you as that. They might describe you as a hard worker, but they're not going to look and say, man, my dad didn't care. They're going to say, man, my dad worked his guts out and he still found time to be with us.
Yeah. In today's world, there's so many distractions, and I can imagine, I don't know what it's like to drive a monster truck, but I can imagine you're making critical split second decisions a lot. But I also think back to, like, it probably comes with a lot of preparation and practice. You know, you get better and you develop. And I kind of liken that to fatherhood, because there's split second decisions, whether you like it or not, where you're on the couch scrolling your phone and your kid's playing in front of you. There's a split second decision to put the phone down. There's a split second decision to not raise your voice and to handle it properly and to show emotional intelligence, you know, and all these things I think come with a lot of practice. But I think just recognizing these things, that's step one, you know, and it's a lot easier said than done. What do you do with your family to create memories? Like, what do you guys like to do?
Well, we love the lake. We bought a lake house a couple of years ago, and man, that is my haven. Because I can go out there, we can do a fire pit at night and roast marshmallows and do all that stuff, jump out on the boat, do the jet ski. And that has come alive for us. And even before the lake, honestly, it's the ability to just watch my kids, you know, like tonight, my wife already put up the Christmas tree and it's November. What is today? November 2nd.
Second. Yeah.
Yeah. She's decorating for Christmas. And like, I, you know, am somewhat annoyed. Until I sat there and got to watch my son had so much fun at 6 years old decorating the tree with my wife. And man, I do this all the time too. I tell my wife, I'm like, I try to take these mental snapshots, and I tell her, I said, if I'm afraid of anything, I'm afraid I'm not going to remember like the little moments, these little memories like that.
Yeah.
And man, that's tough. And you're right. It's like, man, honestly, I'd say probably a greater fear than that is all of us at our age, your age, my age, one day our kids are going to have an opinion on our phone usage.
Yeah.
You know, that's terrifying. I don't know. I don't want my kids. And we don't realize how much we're on our phones and on screens. And it just, I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid they're gonna be like, yeah, we were doing this, but dad was always on his phone or something. Cause I don't think I'm on my phone that much. And one of the things that I love doing is making sure that our phones aren't on the dinner table, but making sure that because they're 8, 6, and 2. And when they finally get phones, when they get older, I'm going to be adamant. Hey, you can't have your phone. Well, are they gonna look at me and go, well, you always had your phone on us up on the dinner table when we went out to eat. Like those things, you're actually building that track record now that's going to create those conversations, make them a lot harder down the road. And if you can put the phone down, just like you said before, and actually live in the moment, like that's huge. And so find the little moments, like whether you're decorating the Christmas tree, whether it's just working on the RC car together, whether it's, you know, just doing a puzzle together, like you'll cherish those memories and they will remember the little things way more. Like, will they remember your trip to Disney? Yes. But they'll actually appreciate building the puzzle with you more than the Disney trip when they're 22 years old. They're going to miss the puzzle nights more than anything.
I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors. I'm just kidding. I don't have any sponsors. I'm a one-man show, but I would appreciate you liking and subscribing and following my journey on social media. I'm working hard to put out relevant and useful content for y'all, and your support means the world to me and it keeps me going. So I really appreciate it. Yeah, I love that. Do you think that the happiest you've ever been is the happiest that you'll ever be?
The happiest I've ever been is the happiest I'll ever be. I don't. That's an interesting way to phrase that, Jace. Look at you. You're like a philosophizer, if I can quote
Ben Stiller. I'm trying.
Yeah, what movie was that? You know, Philosophizer. I don't know if that was oh gosh, now I'm gonna blank.
Zoolander.
On it. It's not gonna be worth. It was either Zoolander or Dodgeball. I want to say it was Dodgeball. Oh, yeah. What are you, a philosophizer? anyway, I digress. Shout out to both of those movies, but I don't even remember the question. Oh yeah, is the happiest you've ever been the happiest you'll ever be? My immediate reaction is no, because I am one of the happiest people you'll ever meet. But I do have a secret. I think happiness is a really stupid goal. I think that the worst advice that we could ever get is do what makes you happy. And we bought into this as a society. You hear like celebrities say it all the time, like, oh, you know, chase your happiness, yeah, chase your truth, chase this, chase, yep, that. And I think it's weak. I really think it's weak to have that as a focus. Now, I'll give you a quick disclaimer. I don't think unhappiness is the goal, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But happiness is a byproduct. It is not the target. And like I said, I'm one of the happiest people that you'll ever meet, but I don't strive for happiness. I strive for purpose. The more meaning I have in my life, the happier I am. So we shouldn't spend our time trying to be happier people. Like we should spend our time finding meaning and living in our purpose. And guess what? Like everyone's like, Bryce, you don't understand, man. You sound like you've had an easy life. Someone said that to me one time and my wife came unglued because she knows my story. And I don't know if I've had a hard life or an easy life. Trust me, I meet more people every day and I'd be like, dude, they had a way harder life than me, right? Yeah. And so I don't claim to have a hard life or an easy life. But my wife came unglued because she was just like, how could they don't have a clue what you've been through and what you've battled through. And I'm like, yeah, I know, but that's not for me to say. But I'm one of the happiest people in my life. Like I said, not because my life is easy, but because I have found meaning even in my pain. If someone buys a book, even before they buy my book, Geared for Life, go buy a book called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, Frankl. Have you read that?
Yes.
Do you have a big takeaway from that book?
I don't
it
know.
It sure as heck wasn't. That book, I can tell you one thing, that book sure as heck doesn't say just do what makes you happy. I think, right, Viktor Frankl would, if anyone's listening and they haven't read it, the first half of the book is how Viktor Frankl survives the Holocaust. It was his experience during the Holocaust in Auschwitz and multiple concentration camps. The second half of the book was the psychological things that he took from that experience to help find meaning, not only in his own life, but he became a professional psychiatrist and psychologist, and he helped people and counsel people through life. And he applied things that he saw and learned through the Holocaust into everyday life. It's unbelievable. But one of the big things is, you know, how man search for meaning, how to find that meaning. So, okay, I've given you enough time to think through. Did you have a big takeaway, Jace, from that before I tell my point from the book? Or do you remember
my takeaway? I don't remember a lot. I just remember that I found it very interesting that he was actually able to find purpose in the darkest moments of his life, yeah, in a place where he didn't have options, but he still found purpose.
Yes. There was, you know, he talks about three ways to find meaning. The first, he says, you know, by the people you meet and the things that you experience. But the third one he makes, and of course I'm blanking on the second one, but I was setting that up to get to the third one anyway. He says, sometimes the meaning we find is from unavoidable suffering. I think about a family that's going through pediatric cancer, and I help a lot of families that are going through pediatric cancer all the time because a lot of them are Monster Jam fans. So I hear their stories and you can't help but be moved. And you're like, what can we do to help you guys? Yeah. And we've done more of that in the last 8 years than I care to even talk about because it's really actually pretty hard. You watch a kid suffer. Now, do I think that kid was meant to suffer so that I could learn some life lesson? Absolutely not. I'm a Christian. I believe in God, and that's a big thing. Well, how can you believe in a God that gives a kid cancer? I don't think the God I know doesn't give a kid cancer. How could he allow cancer? Like, those are deep theological questions that I'm like, I don't believe he does allow that to happen. Oh, so he's not all powerful. It's like, it's getting into this deeper theological question I love to have with people. But the point I'm trying to make is, you know, that child, Viktor Frankl says, suffering ceases to be suffering the minute it finds a meaning. And so he's trying to say through this process of this, and if someone's gone through something very traumatic in their life, that's why they need to pick up this book, because he talks about how even the worst situations, like him in the middle of a concentration camp, watching people around him die every day, it's not that he looked at that and said, oh, I'm meant to go through this to find some life lesson. It's when, as soon as he began to find beauty from those ashes, meaning he could take the lesson of it and go help somebody else, he found that he was no longer suffering when he allowed the trauma and the stuff that he went through to benefit somebody else. It was no longer the same suffering. And I think that is incredibly profound. And so it goes back to what he's talking about. Like, man's search for meaning, he gives very applicable ways to find our purpose and to find meaning in our lives. And I'm a big believer that it's things that we've accomplished. That's what it is. It's either something you've accomplished, it's people you've met or a place you've experienced. Maybe you find your purpose through, you know, you visited Europe and all of a sudden, you know, you just fell in love with Europe and found a passion for that. Now all of a sudden you're going to find your purpose through, you know, equipping your passion to be, you know, the biggest ambassador America's ever seen to Europe. I don't know. Right. But those are those three things: something you've accomplished or, you know, accomplishing a deed, people you've experienced or unavoidable suffering. And I don't know of another category. I've not found another category in those three, but I think we've made finding our purpose and finding meaning through our life way harder. And I talk a lot about that in my book, Geared for Life, about how to find your purpose and how to equip your passion to go out there and find it and to live it every single day. But that's what we're missing. And so if someone's going to pick up a book other than Geared for Life, please pick up Man's Search for Meaning. You won't regret it. It's very helpful. It's incredibly impactful. And it's shaped a lot of my day-to-day grind, and it keeps me in my purpose more than probably any other book has done.
Awesome. Bryce, you're speaking my language. The last, I don't know, 10 episodes or so, we have really hammered on this topic of having a purpose. And also, fathers having a purpose outside of fatherhood. I think it's very healthy to find hobbies and interests that you serve yourself and other people outside of fatherhood, so you don't feel so buried in the responsibility of fatherhood, right? There's balance in these things. So I love that you mentioned that, and you put it in a lot better way than I did. So thank you.
No, I love that. And that's a deep, honestly, the purpose of being a dad is so deep. That is right. Really deep. Like the ripple effects that we have is generational. It's not just, you know, you impact your company and their bottom line and how that affects your boss's life. It's like we're building these little humans, and none of us feel like we're doing it right. None of us. As much as you and I, Jace, can talk about fatherhood and you've had amazing guests on, I can't imagine, man, you could talk about being a dad and being a great dad every single day. Like, I envy you because it keeps you focused on that best dad version that you can be and want to be. But dude, I know even you, like, I know that you don't feel like you're doing it, you know, certainly not perfectly, but I would imagine you don't feel like you're really great at it. And I know you are, just from talking to you for 45 minutes. So that identity is huge, man. But that purpose, I don't know of a greater purpose than to teach truth to our children and hopefully that they live in truth.
Yeah. You know, when I started this podcast, it gave me purpose outside of a marketing career. I always thought to myself, what am I doing here in this world? What impact am I making? And I knew I needed a purpose, and the podcast has given me that purpose to strive towards. And I always thought, you know, I'm gonna have an impact talking to these fathers, and, you know, we could change the world one father at a time. But I realized in the last 15 episodes or so, that if we really want to change the world, we need to have good men raise good kids. And it's really the kids that are going to change, because we're men, we're set in our ways. We're, you know, we're We're men. There's no better way to put it than just we're men, you know?
Yeah.
So, but if we as men can improve and raise good people, I think it will have an impact on the world.
How old are your kids, by the way?
I have a 3-year-old boy and a 6-month-old daughter.
Oh, six-month-old. Man, that's incredible. Yeah. All right, so maybe you wouldn't be able to answer this one quite yet. And I know it's your podcast, so I don't want to ask you questions, right? I'm not hijacking your episode here. But, man, you hear a lot of people. How would you, if your 3-year-old could describe you well, and I know a 3-year-old can't describe anything well because, you know, they're three. How do you think they would describe you today as a dad?
I would say a zeal for life, a passion for serving others and helping others to find their purpose, and also someone that just goes after it, someone that acts fast on his decisions and owns them.
Yeah.
And someone that's not on his phone.
Do you think he'd describe you as a perfect dad?
Absolutely not.
So how would he describe your weaknesses?
Like as far as listing them out or describing.
Yeah, or not to put you on the spot or anything like that by any means, but I know that you don't feel like you're the best version yet, do you? Like what are differences that from between now and 1 year from now? Like the better version, the better dad version of Jace 12 months from today. Like, what does that look like? What changes from today to 12 months from now to be that better version as a dad for you?
The number one thing I'd say is more disciplined with my time management. I have a lot of irons in the fire, and one always has to be put on the back burner for the others to succeed. And managing that is where I'm going to find success.
Mm. And it's interesting. It's interesting because, like, that's what I'm talking about. The, like, that's a what, you know, like, what would you do differently? That's the what side, but it's because you just described the who you want to be and how you want to be described as a father previously to that. Right. Right before that. So then now all of a sudden what you need to do over the next 12 months to become that better version, it's easier to see because of how you said you could be described, which is someone that has a zeal for life. That's someone that's committed to helping other people. Like that's all who you want to become. And in order to do that, you've got to get better at time management. And that's what I'm saying. I think people need to find hope again in shifting into this next gear they never knew they had, if they've got a clearer picture of who they want to become, instead of being so frustrated that they're not doing enough, that they're doing the wrong things. The what is not your problem. The who, you don't have a clear enough picture of who you want to become 1 year from today. It's not just how you want to be described at your funeral. It's how would you want to be described 1 year from today, the type of person you want to become through all of this process. And when you do that, the what gets a lot easier. And that's what I would challenge people to do is, man, you're trying to figure out, so many people are so frustrated because they're trying to figure out all the answers to life. They want the secret to life. And Jace, I know you and I would agree, there's no secret to being a dad. Like it's a grind. You got to work at it every day, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But the same thing is in life more broadly. There's no secret to life. You just have got to find that next gear that you never knew you had. And in order to do that, you got to know what you believe. And so if you'll read Geared for Life, by the end of the book, here's my goal. By the end of the book, someone gets to the end of Geared for Life, they're going to probably steal a few of my gears. They'll probably steal my purpose-driven gear, my built-for-others gear, my fail-faster gear, maybe my make-memories-not-egos gear. But I also think they're going to uncover their own gears and gears of their own. It's going to cut them open and go, man, I do believe that. Maybe you'll read one of my gears and some of my stuff and go, I don't believe what he believes, right? And what it's going to do is going to create in you something you believe that you're going to be able to latch onto and leverage the very next day at your job. And it's going to drive you into a different action and things will start to change. Do things change immediately? No, but just like a car doesn't shift from first gear to fifth gear when it's going on the highway, right? When you're on that on-ramp and you're trying to go 75 miles an hour before you merge onto the highway, you turn at the stoplight, you hit the on-ramp, first gear, revs up to 7,000, you know, not 7,000 RPM, 4,000 RPM, it shifts to second, and then it revs up to third, and then to fourth, and then to fifth, and now you're going 75 miles an hour. People have got to stop trying to go from first gear to fifth gear. We got to get them really good at going from first to second, and then kind of getting the most out of second gear you can, and then we're going to help you shift to third. And that's what I hope my Geared for Life book does for people.
I love it. Let my audience and anyone else that's watching know where they can find you.
Yeah, so I do a lot on Instagram. So at Warrior Bryce. It's at Warrior Bryce on TikTok. I'm doing more on YouTube, and I do a lot of public speaking. And so I love putting stuff as much as I can up on YouTube as well. And I'm enjoying a lot of that, but the book itself, go on Amazon, Books and Million, Barnes and Noble, anywhere books are sold, and pick up a copy of Geared for Life. And I know you'll love it. And if you don't love it, you just message me on Instagram and I'll give you your money back. I know you're going to love it. I know it's going to make a difference. And I can't wait, because I've already heard incredible feedback. Like, go on Amazon and read through the reviews that people have left on Geared for Life. Like, it's incredible. And it's not because I'm some magician as an author. It's not. I believe I'm an author, right? Until I became one, like I talked about earlier. But the answer is because it resonates, man. And my stories, it's not because I'm better than anybody. It's because I have simply found one gear at a time. And now I know how to shift into the right gear at the right time. And this book's going to help you do that. So anywhere books are sold, get on there, get a copy. And jump on Instagram, jump on social media, follow along with the story of all the crazy stuff. And watch me do some backflips for a living and go be a professional crash test dummy all around the world.
Awesome. Well, Bryce, I really appreciate your stories, thoughts, and insights, and proud to call you a new friend and proud of you as a father. So thank you.
Thank you, Jace. I appreciate that. Hey, where are you located, by the way?
I'm in Spanish Fork, Utah.
Okay. And how far is that from like Salt Lake?
I'm about 50 minutes south.
Okay. Right. All right. So 15. Next time we come through Salt Lake City, we got to get you and your 3-year-old son out there. And we're going to make you guys full-time Mohawk Warrior fans. And by the end of it, we're going to have you booing. You're going to be booing Gravedigger. All right. That's going to be our goal.
Okay. Let's do it. We'll have our Mohawks ready.
All right. That sounds good. All right, buddy. I appreciate you having me on too.
Okay. Thanks, Bryce.